to session one of the Depression and Anxiety Recovery Program. We're glad that you made the decision to participate in this program. Over 10,000 individuals have completed this program successfully in every inhabited continent of the world. And numerous studies have been done on these individuals to show that this mental health education program does result in recovery from various forms of depression as well as anxiety disorders. So I'm glad you're here to experience this benefit. When I was a young physician out of training as an internal medicine physician, I was seeing a lot of patients with advanced and complex physical diseases of their internal organs. Many of them also had depression and anxiety and were on medications. I noticed those medicines could help in altering some of their symptoms, but their follow-up mental health tests still showed that they had significant depression and anxiety, and now they were dealing with the side effects of the medicine. So I began to do research to see what else could help my patients in addition to the medication. As I was doing this research, one of my own receptionists had had a series of significant losses in her life, and on top of that, had slipped on the ice, fallen backwards, and had traumatic brain injury, was actually knocked out. Within a few weeks of that, severe depression, was crying in the office, and she says, "Dr. Nedley, I know you're doing research on this. Is there something that I can do besides medicine?" Well, we actually did put her on a medication. Since she had anxiety with that depression, we chose a medicine called Paxil. And that Paxil got rid of her crying spells, but it caused an I don't care attitude. So when happy things were occurring, she didn't actually feel very happy. In addition, she noticed she was more impulsive, and that I don't care attitude was pervasive. So she came back to me and says, "Dr. Nedley, what are you researching? I know there's other things that can be done." And so I began to implement this program in her life. And what a difference it made. She was able to get rid of her depression and anxiety, and she was able to eventually wean off the Paxil, which she was so happy to be off of. Well, as a receptionist, she could not help but tell her story to the patients that came in with medicines and with depression and anxiety. And pretty soon, it seemed like everyone in the town with depression and anxiety was coming to see me. And my slots were filled up, and I was overworking. And I said, we have to find another approach than seeing one patient at a time. A lot of this is just simple mental health education. Let's put this together in a program that everyone can utilize. And that was the beginning of the Community Depression and Anxiety Recovery Program. And as we get started, let's take some time to explain a few things. One of those is the difference between situational depression and major depression. If you've had emotional trauma within the past 2 weeks that has precipitated the depression, the psychiatric Bible calls that adjustment disorder with depressed mood or situational depression. If it was not precipitated by an emotional traumatic event, it is called major depression or clinical depression. And this is thought to be even more severe and difficult to treat, and it's known as also endogenous depression. For situational depression, often we just have to adjust to the new situation. But fortunately, this program has been shown to help with both forms of depression, including even other forms such as seasonal affective disorder, dysthymia, and bipolar depression as well. So how can I know if it's major depression? If you experience at least 5 of these 9 symptoms for the majority of the time for at least 2 weeks without recent obvious emotional trauma, you have endogenous or major depression. Those symptoms are deep sadness or emptiness. Sometimes you'll get crying spells or feelings of hopelessness can occur. The second very common symptom is apathy. This is when you wake up in the morning and you're not excited about the day. You get up out of responsibility and interest, and you have this sense of duty, but you're not really interested in the day. It can get so bad that things that used to be pleasurable are no longer pleasurable for you. Even maybe certain crafts or hobbies that you've had, you haven't picked up in a while because you have lost that interest. That's a severe form of apathy and one of the classic symptoms of depression. Increase in irritability or slowing down, what we call psychomotor retardation, where your mind and body seem to have slowed down, is also a symptom. But most people don't notice symptom number three themselves. So I would encourage you to ask a loved one, am I more irritable than I used to be? Am I slowing down in any way? And if they say yes, then you can chalk up that third symptom. Fourth symptom are sleep disturbances. Many people think of insomnia, and that's one of them. When your head hits pillow and your mind keeps going, you're not able to go to sleep and the minutes and hours tick away. But more common than that is when you're able to go to sleep and you wake up too early and can't get back to sleep. You might need to get up at 6 and you're getting up at 4 and there's no alarm and you can't go back to sleep. And the more severe the depression, the earlier you tend to wake up. So then it can be even 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning. But it can also go the other way where you're sleeping too much. We had one individual come to our program that was sleeping 20 hours a day. She was barely awake long enough to survive and to be able to eat and stay clean enough to survive. And fortunately, she also significantly improved in this program. And so if you're wanting to sleep all the time, or when you're not working, you'd just rather stay in bed, that could be hypersomnia, and you have symptom number 4. Symptom number 5 are weight or appetite changes. Most common is weight gain from self-medicating with junk food or carbs, sodas, sugary foods, chocolate. If there's a predilection for these things, chances are you might have those weight or appetite changes, but it could also result in anorexia and weight loss. Interestingly, in our program, we'll notice those that are underweight gain weight and those that are overweight lose weight by correcting the mental health and brain biochemistry that the program addresses. Lack of concentration. This is when you wake up in the morning and you're reading now something that's interesting to you, but you get to the bottom of the page and you realize you forgot what was at the top of the page. And you might go through it again, and you get to the bottom of the page and you realize you forgot it again. That's severe lack of focus, and that can occur not only when you wake up in the morning, but anytime throughout the day. And that is a common symptom of depression. Even memory can be adversely affected because you don't have that focus. Fatigue is when you don't have the energy. Remember, apathy was you don't have the interest, but some people have the interest, but they just don't have the energy. And that would be fatigue, or they run out of energy too early in the day. Feelings of worthlessness is a sign of severity. Every human being is worthwhile, of infinite value. And if you can be of help to yourself or others, you're clearly not worthless. But people with major depression will come to me and tell me that they believe for sure they are completely worthless and their families would be better off without them. This is irrational thinking that comes along with depression as a sign of severity. The 9th symptom is morbid thoughts. This is when you're preoccupied with death or symbols of death. Some people actually tattoo symbols of death on themselves. My wife showed me a bathing suit line that had nothing but crossbones and skeletons on them, and women were buying them up in large numbers, a sign of resonating with those morbid thoughts, with the increase in depression and severe depression that's occurred throughout our land. Or if you just would rather go to sleep and not wake up again, that's morbid thoughts, and that is a sign of severe depression. So you don't have to have all of those symptoms, 5 of 9. If you have 2 of 9, that's minor depression. That's still not completely normal. It's only normal if you have 0 or 1, as long as that 0 or 1 is not symptom number 8 or 9. Generalized anxiety disorder is excessive worry or fear. You didn't see that in the depression part of things. If you just have pure depression, you're not really concerned about the future. It's more of the present. But generalized anxiety disorder people are concerned about the future. Excessive fear or worry about a variety of topics, events, or activities. And they'll tend to have three or more of these following six symptoms: feeling on edge or restless, muscle aches or soreness, easily becoming fatigued or worn out, concentration problems, irritability, and difficulty sleeping. So if you notice those symptoms, those final four are the same as in depression. And so there's an overlap between depression and anxiety. However, these top three are not part of depression, and we tend to see more of the chronic pain and the aches and the feeling on edge with anxiety. So three of six, as long as you have worry and fear, the final six, three of six, is generalized anxiety. If you're a child, you only need one of those six, fear and worry plus one of those six. And we're seeing a lot more anxiety among children today. There are other forms of anxiety that we will address and has been shown to improve in the program. Panic disorder. With panic disorder, it's not having these symptoms the majority of the time, it's having them at the same time when you're having a panic episode. So you may not be having these symptoms a lot, but when you have the panic episode. And there are 13 different types of symptoms that you can get with panic disorder. But you'll have to have four of those 13. So let's go through those. Palpitations, pounding heart or accelerated heart rate, sweating, trembling or shaking, shortness of breath or smothering, a feeling of choking, chest pain or pressure, nausea or abdominal distress, feeling dizzy, unsteady, lightheaded, or faint. So normally, it's very rare for someone to get all of these symptoms, but it is common for them to get several of them during their panic episodes. In addition, feelings of unreality or being detached from oneself, almost like you're disassociating. Fear of losing control or going crazy is common, as well as fear of dying. Numbness or tingling sensations are also common, as well as chills and hot flashes. So those 13 symptoms are good to have in front of you, and start checking off. If you get four or more of those at once, you have panic disorder. It's a form of anxiety disorder, and you'll need to pay attention in regards to how to improve that condition. It can improve quite readily with some simple measures. Then there are other forms of anxiety, the phobias. One of them is called agoraphobia, which is where you're anxious about places or situations from which escape might be difficult, or in which you might feel trapped, helpless, or embarrassed. And so many people have this tendency to stay home. One individual with agoraphobia had not been out of her house for 4.5 years before she came to this program. First time she was out of her house, her daughter drove her to this program. And after this program, she's been out of her house every day and has lived a good life, anxiety-free. Social anxiety or social phobia has become more common today, particularly in our younger generation, but this is where everyday interactions cause significant anxiety, self-consciousness, and embarrassment because you fear being scrutinized or judged negatively by others. And so if that fear of scrutiny is there, that's social anxiety and social phobia. Then social appearance disorder. This is where you are fearful of being seen because you don't think your appearance is as pleasing as it should be. This results in eating disorders. Excessive worry about appearance, size, shape, or weight can lead to anorexia or bulimia. Another very common condition that we've treated almost every day since we've come up with this program is obsessive compulsive disorder. The person has obsessions, compulsions, or both, and the obsessions or compulsions take up a lot of time, usually more than an hour a day, and they can cause distress and affect your participation in social or work life or life events. one of the women that improved significantly in our program. Her husband was a farmer, and just taking that dirt from the soil in with his boots would make her clean everything and spend all of these hours. And finally, he got to the point where he said, I think I'm just going to go home to my mom and dad so you don't have to work so much when I come home. And that's when she realized, I better get help. She was cleaning excessively, and her attention to things that were far more important were being neglected. Post-traumatic stress disorder. This is when you get triggered into depression or anxiety or a flashback with words, objects, situations, or even your own thoughts and feelings can trigger yourself. And this can drive you to avoid situations where this might occur. Now, after a traumatic event, it is normal to experience these triggers for about a month. But if it lasts more than a month, that's PTSD. Complex post-traumatic stress disorder comes from ongoing trauma that continues or repeats for months or years. And fortunately, PTSD has also been shown to get significant improvement with the approaches in this program. And then there are specific phobias. There are phobias in regards to an exaggerated or unrealistic sense of danger about a situation or object. One of those that I'm sure you've heard of is claustrophobia, where you have this fear of getting into tight spaces and you can't even get an MRI exam. Vehophobia is the fear of driving. Atychophobia is the fear of failure. Autophobia is the fear of being alone. Arachnophobia is the fear of spiders. Decidophobia is fear of making the wrong decision. And the list goes on. And we can smile about these things, but I can tell you, for those who have it, it is no smiling matter. And it is something that impairs their life, can even impair how they drive, and even avoid bridges, and if they have that vehophobia and phobias of bridges. And so we deal with these things on a common, everyday basis, and fortunately, there's a solution for any phobia that you might have as well. So depression and anxiety and all of these symptoms would be bad enough if they just caused what we were talking about. But unfortunately, these symptoms are just the tip of the iceberg. Depression can cause suicide. Depending on the society of young people, this is either the first, second, or third leading cause of death of young people throughout the world. And suicide remains in the top 10 causes of death in most societies today and is on the increase. Anxiety greatly suppresses the immune system. The suppression of the immune system can make many diseases, even cancer and viral infections, more serious. And even heart disease is more likely in some groups. The self-medicating with addictions also decreases the quantity and the quality of life. Cigarette smoking has been shown to shorten both the quality and quantity of life substantially, but not resolving depression and anxiety can result in similar reductions in the quality and quantity of life as cigarette smoking. And in regards to the quality, it can even decrease it significantly further. Some studies show a 10-year decrease in life expectancy if you don't get this situation resolved. So persons with anxiety and depression can actually die as a result of these complications. And studies now show almost 4% of deaths in the world are due not to a physical disease, but to the effects of depression and anxiety. It also results in missed days of work, decreased work productivity, and more sick days. Lifetime loss of $300,000 for each family who has a depressed family member. And this is 10 years ago. We know it's more financially problematic today than it was then. Decreased academic performance. We have many people that are accepted into colleges because of their high ACT scores and GPA in high school, but they're not performing, not due to their IQ. They have the IQ, but it's their motivation from the depression or anxiety. More chronic illness with aches and pains. Adverse effect on relationships of all kinds in school and work in the family, as well as the death rates that we talked about. Well, how is this disease treated today? As it is going off the charts in regards to the increased risk that every society seems to be under in regards to more depression and anxiety. Still, the number one treatment today is medications. And around 50% of patients will experience an improvement in their mood or other symptoms. But only 27% of patients taking antidepressants long-term will feel stable with their medication usage and not relapse. That's a pretty small number. And when we looked at that 27%, most of them were actually on other therapies in addition to medicine that were simple therapies that could help their condition. So very few of those that responded were on just medication alone. They were using other modalities. 30% of patients don't improve with any medicine. So there's a lot of people that go to different doctors and trying to get different medicines, and they don't realize they have what's called treatment resistant, meaning no pharmaceutical agent is going to help them. That means that they can respond to other modalities and will respond. A lot of people think, hey, if my doctor called me treatment resistant because no medicines are working, then nothing's going to work. Not true. Those individuals respond very well often to nutritional and lifestyle and a thought therapy. 45% of those taking medicines report unpleasant side effects. And if you take a list of adverse effects, 60% of patients will report that they're having those adverse effects. And 40% quit taking their medicine because of these side effects. Often they don't even tell their doctor about it. They just say, hey, I couldn't take that side effect, and I'd rather have the depression and anxiety than the symptoms of these side effects. Relapse rates are also important to recognize. The majority of patients who stop antidepressants relapse within a year. This is why many people think they need to continue to take their medicine like their morning vitamins, because without it, they're going to crash. Those who continue medicine also relapse, however. About 40% of them will relapse within a year of taking the medicine. We'll explain that a little more in some sessions coming up on what's happening there. But this is pretty significant. Almost half of people, although they get better initially, are going to relapse in about a year. And continuing medicine will help 15% of those patients not to relapse. So that's an important 15%, but it's far better to get to the root cause that we're going to be talking about here. And once we reverse that cause, then we'll have far better long-term results and far better relapse rates. So medication has its place. I'm not opposed to medicine as a doctor. I also prescribe it. But it can't be used as the ultimate solution. Medication should be reserved for those with moderate to severe depression and anxiety because of the side effect profile, if we have milder forms. But the definite goal should be to discontinue your medicine within 6 to 12 months in most cases. And that will occur if the underlying causes are reversed and eliminated. If this program is carried out, you can expect a response to both depression and anxiety based on the thousands of individuals who have been through this ahead of you. So as we have described depression and anxiety, notice it's just a constellation of symptoms. It doesn't give any indication to the cause, even though you've been diagnosed. And traditional medicine just diagnoses, then goes to treatment. Lifestyle medicine and internal medicine, which is based on finding the underlying cause, diagnoses the disease and then goes to a workup to find the precise underlying causes. And that gives us a wonderful opportunity to produce significant improvement that we can't produce with the medicines of today. Even the newer medicines do not have that type of response. So if we want to increase the likelihood of a long-term solution, we must identify the causes of depression and systematically treat them. And this, of course, is not as simple a process as just prescribing a drug. Like most chronic diseases, depression has many causes. But the most effective treatments will be based on an all-fronts attack on as many causes identified to be operative. And this can be done more simply than many people realize. A number of years ago, as I was going through the research that I explained earlier in this session, we actually published this with Dr. Ramirez in the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine, called the HIT hypothesis. This was based on our own clinical experience where we noticed that the brain was very resilient. It could undergo one cause, two causes, three causes, no depression and anxiety. But once there was a fourth cause, depression and anxiety resulted. So that was the hypothesis. We tested it in thousands of individuals and found that hypothesis true. Our brains are wonderfully designed to undergo quite a bit, but not multiple hits at the same time. So when you get four or more, that's when you're going to tip over the edge into a mental illness. 100 causes of depression and anxiety we discovered, but they could be categorized into 10 categories. So let's go through those categories. There's genetic causes. Those might be genetic mutations that are making it more difficult for you to be able to produce certain chemicals in your brain. There's developmental causes, adverse childhood experiences or neglect that you have experienced. There are lifestyle causes. This has to do with maybe exercise or light or other lifestyle factors that are playing a role. Circadian rhythm is a big one. Our bodies and brains work best when we're on a regular schedule, regular sleep-wake schedule, and circadian rhythm is our daily rhythms. Nutrition causes are also significant. Toxins can also play a role. Social causes, too much stress, not handling the stress, losses, trauma. This is all under the category of social causes. In addition, addiction causes are significant, and also medical conditions can be playing a role. Autoimmune disease, glandular disease like thyroid disease, and other medical conditions can play a role. And then finally, frontal lobe causes. The frontal lobe is the control center of the brain right here in the front portion of the brain, and there's a number of things that can cause that to go down where we're not able to manage our emotions as well. So again, one of those categories is not going to be enough. You can have bad genes, even bad upbringing, and not have depression if you don't have other causes. But once that fourth cause is there, then you'll have more depression. And the more causes that are operative, the more severe that depression and anxiety is going to be. So today, we are going to go through some things that are not only about diagnosis and causes and complications, but we're actually going to give you some simple modalities right here in the first session that can make a big difference in how your brain is going to operate in the future. We mentioned that lifestyle category. If you're not on a regular exercise program, you have a lifestyle hit. Physical fitness is actually better for your brain than it is your body. And when you are not fit, your receptors go down in your brain. Your neurotransmitters are not as easily released. And so it has an adverse effect on your what we call synaptic activity. Not being exposed to daylight at least 60 minutes a day. This isn't indoor light. It has to be daylight. It has to be bright enough to be able to take a picture with regular film speed, with old cameras, without flash bulbs. And that bright lux going through the eyes actually helps us to produce more serotonin. And we'll get more serotonin activity, which is a mood enhancer as well as something to help us away from panicking and anxiety. Not regularly being exposed to fresh air is also a lifestyle hit. So city living where there's pollution can have a significant adverse effect. So how do we correct lifestyle hits? Long, brisk walks, preferably outdoors and fresh air, are beneficial in reducing depression and anxiety. And it will also improve circulation of the blood to the brain. Exercise and antidepressants are equally effective. There was a study utilizing Zoloft, one of the most common sertraline, it's one of the most common antidepressants, and we found out a regular fitness program actually improved the brain as well as Zoloft did, but without the relapse rates. In other words, Zoloft, you're going to relapse 40% within a year. As you continue exercising, you don't relapse if you improved with the exercise. And so you've already learned something already that's as good as medicine, and that is starting on a fitness program. So hour-long walks are good. Minimum of 7 days are needed for positive results in most cases of depression. So you're not going to feel better day one. You won't feel better day two. Day three, you won't feel better, and you're wondering, is this working? It takes 7 days for it to start working. But notice, if you have anxiety, it'll start working within 2 to 3 days. In fact, we've had some patients say that their first bout of fitness exercise improved their anxiety after that exercise session. So it can start to improve anxiety even quicker than depression. Physical exercise has also shown to help social phobia or social anxiety. It's also been shown to help panic disorder, and especially when it's combined with cognitive behavioral therapy. This is the therapy about the thoughts. So it's not just the exercise part, but actually working on analyzing our thoughts and correcting our thoughts will also help with panic. Panic disorder not only responds to cardio exercise, which cardio has been shown to be the best for most mental illnesses, but panic disorder also responds to working out. So getting in the gym can also help with panic disorder. Post-traumatic stress disorder also responds to exercise. A lot of people are not aware of that. They think PTSD is beyond exercise, that you're going to need some sort of specialized form of therapy. But exercise plus cognitive behavioral therapy produces the best response with PTSD. In addition, it restores dysfunction of the stress hormone glands in the body. That means your cortisol levels start to go down when you improve your anxiety with exercise. We used to measure everyone's cortisol levels when they had anxiety. We don't do that anymore. They're all off the charts, very high. The body is really trying to respond to all this excessive fear and worry by tearing down the system, essentially. But when we get on the exercise program and we start to get fit, not only does the anxiety get better, the cortisol levels also start to go down. And that will improve your learning and memory. In fact, your brain ages much quicker when that cortisol level is high. When it goes down low, you can keep that brain young and healthy. In addition, it prevents brain-derived neurotrophic factor reduction with stress. We're going to talk about that, but BDNF is a natural antidepressant, and this is exciting new research that shows that when we get on a good exercise program, our BDNF levels go up, and that means they won't go down with stress. So even if we're stressed and we're on an exercise program, we are greatly benefited by this. Physical exercise has been shown to reduce inflammatory markers in the bloodstream as well as at the cellular level. So let's go back to this brain-derived neurotrophic factor. This is a protein that we can actually measure in the blood. We can do a venous blood level of BDNF. And it acts as a brain fertilizer, and it turns on what we call the positive neuroplasticity switches in the brain. These are the switches that make your brain ready for positive changes. And so exercise is a key number one ingredient. This is why we're talking about it on program one, to get that BDNF level up so that you can start to have more positive changes throughout these 8 weeks. BDNF helps the brain develop new connections, repair failing brain cells, and protect healthy brain cells. In addition, high levels of BDNF make it easier to acquire knowledge, and we want you to acquire knowledge and retain that knowledge and apply it here. And BDNF will help you not only do that, but it will also help you to feel happier. When BDNF levels fall, learning becomes more difficult, and even dementia can occur. BDNF levels being low increases your risk of dementia, and depression, of course, is much more common. Having enough BDNF can even protect the brain from neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. And so I really want you to work on getting these BDNF levels up. We're going to find several ways to get them up, but one of the simplest ways is getting on an aerobic fitness program. Additional benefits of exercise on mental well-being is that it helps us with the adverse effects of sleep deprivation. So if you're deprived from sleep, if you can't sleep day after day, week after week, your serotonin levels fall, your norepinephrine level activity goes down in your brain. This increases your risk of all sorts of problems, the anxiety and the depression. But interestingly, if you are on a physical fitness program, even though you're sleep deprived, we will see no drop in those neurotransmitters. So let's put this in perspective for a little bit. A lot of people tell me that they don't exercise because they're not getting enough sleep. They say, I woke up too early, I couldn't go back to sleep, and so I want to be able to sleep in. And by sleeping in, they don't have time for their morning exercise. It would be far better for them to get up and exercise and get an hour less sleep. Because if they stay physically fit, they actually won't have the adverse effects on the brain with those neurotransmitters from the sleep deprivation. And so this is exciting research, and a lot of people are so worried about their sleep that they sabotage themselves in regards to not taking advantage of this physical fitness. In addition, becoming physically fit will make it easier for tryptophan and tyrosine to cross the blood-brain barrier. We're going to talk about those in a couple of sessions from now, but both tryptophan and tyrosine are essential ingredients for our body to make more dopamine, more serotonin, more norepinephrine. And no drug helps you to make those things. We'll talk about how they work later, but they actually are not helping you to make that. But exercise will, because we can get the ingredients that we need for serotonin and dopamine into our brain so that we can make it. Now, some people think, well, wait a minute. If I need more serotonin and dopamine, why don't I go into a hospital and they give me IV serotonin or IV dopamine? Did you know they can give you all the IV serotonin and dopamine that they have in the hospital and you will not get a bit better? Why won't you get better? Because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. It's going to affect other organs where it can get into, but it can't get into your brain. We need the tryptophan and tyrosine in our brain to make the serotonin and dopamine. And that's why these lifestyle factors and nutrition factors are so crucial in improving our brain chemistry. So this just simple exercise of getting out there and walking for an hour can augment your production of those three neurotransmitters in the brain and also improve your focus and attention. Most people that come to our program, we have found, were unfit when they started. And this is session one. You might be unfit as we're starting this program. And you might ask the question, how can I get fitter faster? There is a way. It's called interval training. Interval training means that you are mixing exercise with rest. And that's a little easier. A lot of people think when they go out and exercise, they're just going to get dogged down and they're going to get so tired and then they're going to be sore. But interval training is where you exercise for a minute and you rest for about 40 seconds. Resting for 40 seconds helps your muscles to recuperate. You wash out that lactic acid. You won't have near the muscle soreness. And you'll actually get fitter faster than going out there and overdoing it for an hour and then getting sore the next day and not really being able to do it. Interval training accelerates fitness to a higher level in a shorter time period, and it's been shown to be ideal for both the fit as well as the unfit. The athletes, for instance, in the exercise biking races, they will be in the rest stage when they're hunkered down behind the lead bikist or bicyclist, and then they will finally make it to the top where they're working much harder, and then the others are resting below them. And that's how IT works in those that are very fit. As mentioned, less muscle soreness, and Dr. DeRose and Dr. Meyer from the Lifestyle Center of America also showed that our thyroid function improves a little bit more when we're doing IT versus just regular straight cardio exercise without those short periods of rest. Our goal is for you to get 60 minutes of aerobic exercise. Now, that includes the rest stage if you're doing IT. And this is how much is needed per day until depression or anxiety starts to improve. Once you have depression and anxiety eradicated, you can go down to 45 minutes a day to maintain. Most people can now keep track of their steps, and we recommend set it at 15,000 steps per day. That's your goal, because that'll be 12,500 steps in addition to normal activity. Most normal activity is about 2,500 steps a day, and we want this to be intentional for another 12,500, and that's the area where we will start seeing that significant improvement in day 3 for anxiety and in day 7 for depression. There's another simple measure that helps our brain tremendously, and it's called water. If you're not getting enough hydration, you will have some difficulty in staying focused. You'll have impaired short-term memory, impaired recall of long-term memory. You'll have a diminished ability to even perform mental arithmetic, and you will be fatigued much earlier in the day. In addition, you might get headaches just from the dehydration, and depressed mood becomes more common. A lot of people think, hey, well, it's time for my coffee then. It's time for my milk. It's time for my fruit juice. They've studied those things. Those things do not improve your hydration like water does. They are water substitutes, and they won't improve all of that list that you see there. It's only water that improves that. And so I want to encourage you to drink enough water. Those who drink the least amount of water, which are people that drink 2 glasses or less per day, were compared with those who drink the most in America. And the ones who drink the most are drinking 5 or more glasses per day. And we found out just going from 2 glasses to 5 glasses a day decreased their risk of depression by a whole 50%. In other words, it doubles your risk of depression if you go down to less than 2 glasses of water per day. So let's put that in perspective. If you have chronic insomnia and you can't sleep for weeks, that doubles your risk of depression. So it's the same risk for chronic insomnia as it is for not drinking enough water. And so it's very simple to help your risk just by getting up to 5 or more glasses a day. After researchers controlled for potential confounders, they found that not drinking enough water was associated with a 73% increased risk of depression in men and a 54% increased risk of depression in women. Children also showed improved memory, focus, and cognitive ability after just drinking 1 more glass of water per day. If they drank even more than that, it would be even more improvement. But children will do better academically by drinking more water and staying away from the water substitute beverages. Well, there's a third thing we're going to mention here today on session number 1. We've covered physical fitness, getting on an exercise program. We've covered drinking enough water. And our third aspect is the exercise of gratitude. This is a mental exercise, but there have been some interesting studies in regards to gratitude. Individuals who keep gratitude lists are more likely to progress toward important personal goals. And practicing gratitude every day has been associated with greater alertness, enthusiasm, determination, attentiveness, and energy. In addition, grateful people report higher levels of positive emotions, higher life satisfaction, higher vitality, higher optimism, as well as lower levels of depression and stress. So how do you do this? Think about anything good that has happened this day that you did not cause all by yourself, but you were still able to experience it, and write it down and express it whenever possible that day, or maybe tomorrow, or even later this week. This is developing a gratitude list, and it helps you to remember things that were positive or at least neutral that you're appreciative of, that was not, that you were not 100% solely responsible for. And express it whenever possible, that day, the next day, or even later that week. And I don't want you to put the same things down every day. I want you to think about new things that maybe you haven't thought of before, or a new activity that occurred, and write that down. And as you mix it up, you will have some brain benefits of establishing those gratitude lists. That will also help us to avoid pessimism. Negative automatic thoughts tend to be a major part of depression and anxiety. And one of the ways of helping us to avoid negative automatic thoughts is not only gratitude, but deciding not to say anything critical about anyone or anything for 14 consecutive days. Now, you might say, how can I do that? It's an 8-week program, so you've got time. Most people will fail on day one, and then they start over again. Then they might fail on day three, and they start over again. But most people are able to complete this during the 8 weeks. But it means that you cannot say even out loud something critical about yourself. Now, you can have constructive criticism without being critical. And just thinking about ways in which you can begin to be constructively critical without criticism will improve the software of your brain, that thinking portion of your brain. So I want to encourage you to keep trying until you go 14 consecutive days. After the 14 consecutive days, you can say things critical again, but you will say it far differently now. It will be far more productive, and it will be in a healthier way that will help you and your relationships. So those are the four things that I want you to start on session one. Let's review them. Become physically fit. Drink more water. Gratitude. That's right. Establish the gratitude lists. And I want you to do this on a daily basis. And then number four, don't say anything critical about anyone or anything for 14 consecutive days. That will get you on the right pathway for greater changes coming in session two. And it will help you to not develop the complications of depression and anxiety. Don't wait for those complications. Find out what hits are impairing your brain. By the way, on session one, we want you to take that depression and anxiety assessment test. That'll help you with which one of those 10 hit categories you have that are active. And then choose to eliminate or counteract those active reversible hits in your life. Do everything possible to do that. Get ready for a far better productive life filled with better decisions, better economics, and greater life satisfaction. I know you can start incorporating all four of these principles to help your brain this week, and I want to encourage you, it'll be well worth your effort. Thank you very much.